And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical current, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with columnist and author Kevin Williamson. He covers economics, politics, and culture for the National Review. His latest book is The End Is Near, and It's Going to Be Awesome, How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. And he joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, Kevin Williamson.
Hi, thank you.
And welcome. Good to have you. So one of the main questions you pose in your book is, why do some classes of goods and services get better, like the iPhone, and cheaper every year, while healthcare, education, and entitlements get more expensive and less effective? So what is the answer to that question?
Well, that's the paradox of politics, is that it's really hard to make people's lives better through coercion. And all political systems operate on a model of coercion, whether it's a very obvious one or a more subtle one. All politics is ultimately conducted at gunpoint, as it were. If you don't want to pay into Social Security, eventually they will dispatch a guy to your house with a gun to cause you to comply. And these aren't just really the best models for solving complex social problems in the 21st century. Government's a pretty blunt instrument. There are things it's good at. It's good at putting people in jail and dropping bombs and that sort of thing. And sometimes those things have to be done. But if you're talking about something really complex like the American healthcare economy, the blunt force of government just isn't really the right tool for the job.
In a recent lecture, Kevin Williamson, you're quoted as saying, American voters are stupid, but compared to everyone else everywhere else, you're actually very smart people. Explain that.
Yeah, didn't quite say that the way I meant to. What I think is American consumers are really smart and American voters are really dumb, and the paradox is that they're the same people. You know, Americans are rich, intellectually sophisticated, economically sophisticated people, but the problem of politics is that all decisions get bundled together into, you know, two brands, as it were, brand R or brand D. And people often end up voting for things, supporting things that really make no sense. And partly that's because it's difficult to understand all of the issues with the depth that you really need to. Well, in fact, it's impossible. Congress doesn't understand them, for that matter. They don't even know what their own bills say, for the most part. But it's also, you know, has to do with the fact that that things get bundled together that don't necessarily go together. So people's opinions about things like, say, abortion or gay rights are linked to their opinions about things like health care or taxes, because of the way that parties operate, the way that campaigns operate, and the way that the legislatures operate. Whereas in the marketplace, you don't really have that. You know, you don't have to go with a certain brand of car because you prefer a certain brand of cell phone.
In the title, you say how going broke will leave America richer, happier, and more secure. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, well, we are at an economic inflection point where the welfare state, as we know it, is entirely unsustainable. You know, if you look at the unfunded liabilities just associated with the big entitlement programs, you're talking about $100 trillion, which is well more than the GDP of the entire planet. It's approaching the value of all the financial assets in existence. So when you have liabilities like that, you're just simply not going to pay them at their present value. It's a mathematical certainty that Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security benefits will not be paid out in the future at their present value. So the question for us then is, what do we do instead? How do we go about reforming, or my preference, replacing these systems with things that work, that aren't ruinous, and that actually do the thing that they're supposed to do? You know, that's the underappreciated aspect of this, I think, often on my side, is that the real problem with things like Medicare and Social Security isn't that they're expensive and inefficient. They are expensive and inefficient. But the real problem is that they don't actually do very much to help the people they're supposed to help. They're not really the long-term solution for poverty, for health care, for poor people. for helping people to fund their retirements and those sorts of things.
But you say that as human beings, we have an obligation, responsibility to help people who can't do it for themselves. But isn't that what entitlement programs are intended to do?
Well, sure, that's what they're intended to do, but they don't. And there's, you know, there's a critical difference between believing that we have a positive obligation to help people, which I do believe, and believing that that necessarily translates to we have a positive obligation to using the state, particularly the federal government, to try to manage people's lives for them and impose our views of how those should be organized on them. And that's just, that's not really the right way to do it. You know, if you look at it as a purely problem-solving issue, if you look at it as just an economic engineering challenge, you know, we're really very good at those sorts of things. You know, I use the cell phone as kind of a it's kind of a totem throughout the book. But, you know, you think about it, 30 years ago, you had to be a millionaire to have one. You had to be, you know, Gordon Gekko on Wall Street. You were the, if you had a cell phone, you had a Rolls Royce. You know, that's the sort of thing it was. And now you can be, you know, you can be poor. You can be 16 years old. And you've got stuff that just simply wasn't even available at that time because we're really good at making things better and cheaper if you leave it to people's own innovation. And it's also a very egalitarian process, as I point out. You know, the lady who works at the coffee shop across from my office here has the same cell phone as the President of the United States, but she doesn't have health care that's as good, and she won't have a retirement that's as good. Her kids certainly won't go to schools that are as good. And that's a real problem because those things are really more important.
What were your views of the Occupy movement?
Occupy got one thing right. And that's that there is an unhealthy relationship between big business and big government, particularly between finance and government. Everything they did after that, of course, was I think, wrong. Occupy, the paradox of Occupy, they understand that there's an unhealthy relationship between big business and big government, and then their solution to that is to make government even bigger, even more intrusive, to give it more power. You know, the difference between government and business is even the worst business, and there are lots of bad businesses out there. You know, there really are evil corporations out there. But in normal circumstances, they can't compel you to do business with them. You know, I'm not a fan of Microsoft. I don't like their products very much, and I kind of don't like their company very much. And Microsoft, being as large a company as it is and as powerful a company as it is, actually can't make me do business with them. I don't buy their stuff. But government can make you do business with them, and bad government programs, things like Medicaid, really can, you know, force people to do business with them, at least to support them financially, and that ends up being a problem. So the thing about Occupy, I guess, is that they're the what I call the wrong kind of anarchist. You know, they think of themselves as being anti-state, but their entire agenda is expanding the power of the public sector, the power of the state, the power of government, and its power to coerce people. And it's funny for me, for people like that, to refer to themselves as anarchists. They seem to be really the opposite.
I'd like to get back to the entitlement program, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the fact that they're unsustainable as they are, but what do you propose to replace them? You say they need to be reformed, they need to be replaced. With what?
Yeah. Well, the idea that there's one replacement, you know, one thing I can tell you to make that happen is part of the problem. You know, one of the problems with the whole political model of thinking is that we think that we can have one thing to solve these problems. You know, healthcare is a superbly complex issue. Helping people to save for their retirement is a pretty complex challenge as well. And, you know, we think, well, we can pass one bill after a 20-year debate, and that's going to solve the problem of health care. Or we can pass, you know, one bill in 1935, and that's going to solve the issue of people's retirements. It's just not. You know, we've got 900 kinds of shampoo on the shelves and one model of things like health care and education and retirement programs. That just simply doesn't make any sense. So part of the thing that I get into in the book is that the belief that even a really smart person, a smart, well-intentioned person, or a team of smart, well-intentioned persons can design a system for something that complex is just not supportable by the evidence. You know, if you look at the measurable complexity of something like the American healthcare economy, You're talking about a quantity of information and relationships among pieces of information that is literally incalculable. It's just not something that can be managed, even by very smart and well-intentioned people. And, of course, not everyone in government is smart and well-intentioned.
But I still don't know what you see as an alternative. You're saying that there isn't one alternative. There should be many. But what does that look like?
Yeah, well, I think if you had, you know, in the age of the telegraph, asked people what their alternative was, they probably wouldn't have predicted something like the iPhone or the Internet. But there they are. So the alternative is not a particular program or a particular system that I can tell you about, but a set of conditions under which we allow those things to emerge. And part of that is limiting or getting rid of the monopolistic power of government over these sectors. So you take something like, you know, healthcare as an example. You have a highly regulated, highly regimented system in which there's no real national market for things like health insurance. And then you're surprised when it doesn't function very well. And rather than helping a market to emerge, for instance, by changing the regulatory structure, by delinking insurance from employment, changing the tax treatment and all the rest of it, what we do is we have another government program come in and say, well, we're going to take this overregulated, overly structured thing and impose more regulations, more structure on it, because we've got this thing called the Independent Payments Advisory Board in Washington, D.C., which is a council of very smart people who mean well, and they're going to make all the decisions for us. And those things just never, ever, ever work out the way you expect them to. So for something like healthcare, you've got obviously market-oriented alternatives. You've got nonprofit-oriented alternatives. You've got models in the past, things like self-insurance systems, mutual aid societies in the 19th century, things like that, that we can look at and see that we've had ways of approaching these problems that were not managed by the federal government or managed by the states or managed by politicians at all. And, of course, we're living in a period of time in which we've got much more sophisticated actuarial tools, much more sophisticated information tools, and of course, much more sophisticated healthcare technology, which suggests to me that that we can have a much more effective and functional market in those things.
We're speaking with Kevin Williamson. He covers the intersection of economics, politics, and culture for National Review and National Review Online. He's an author. His latest book is The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. We'll come back. We need to take a break, and we'll take your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and columnist and author Kevin Williamson. We're discussing his latest book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. Kevin Williams, I was interested in your story of experiencing shopping for a medical procedure when you didn't have insurance. You say that the medical industry used the technology of Charles Dickens, and you were kind of dismayed that you have to fill out by hand that clipboard that they hand you on your first visit.
Yeah.
Expand on that.
Not just the first visit. It's every visit. It's weird. Well, actually, I did have health insurance at the time, but I was thinking about changing jobs. And as you know, when you change jobs, it disrupts your health insurance, which is one of the problems with that market. And so just out of curiosity, I was wondering that if I was going to have this procedure when I was in between jobs and what it was going to cost me, you know, out of pocket. So I called, this is in Washington, D.C., I must have called 20 different providers in the D.C. area, and I simply could not get a price for it. People would give me prices that were, you know, say, well, it might cost $16,000, it might cost $160,000. And when you're buying a car, if you ask for a Honda Civic, they don't tell you, well, it might cost $20,000, it might cost $200,000. You actually can call in and get a price on something. You can get a price on a computer, which is a fairly complex thing. A car is a fairly complex thing. You can buy a submarine and get a price on it, but you can't get a price on basic healthcare stuff. And that's one of the reasons why that market doesn't work, because you don't get functional markets without prices. You know, prices are how economic information is communicated among people. That's how we let each other know about supply and demand. And that simply doesn't happen in healthcare. So that would be an enormous start toward making that a sensible system by having prices that actually work. But of course, the information technology thing is nuts too. You know, I go into my doctor, I go into my dentist, and they give me a pencil and a clipboard and a piece of paper to let them know about my health records and my health situation. And that's pretty, you know, pertinent and sensitive information. But I notice I've never gotten a handwritten bill from one of them. You know, those always seem to be, those are generated by computers. They use those to keep records. They use a very sophisticated system called the credit rating system to track people who don't pay them and that sort of thing. So when it's your interests, it's, you know, 18th century technology. And when it's their interest, it's 21st century technology. And that's an enormous problem. And that's why people hate healthcare. I mean, people, they hate their insurance companies. They dislike even their doctors to an extent, hospital operators. It's a really, really backward system.
Most of that data, though, that you're filling out on the clipboard does get transferred to a computer.
You know, I was curious about that, and I asked a few doctors about that, and different doctors and different kinds of practices, and not as much as you would think. Not nearly as much as you would think. The use of computerized medical records is actually pretty spotty. What I've come to conclude, actually, is that doctors aren't very good at scheduling, and the whole thing with the clipboard and fill this out and tell me this and that is really just a delaying mechanism for people who show up on time. While the doctors figure out when to see them.
There's an old Jerry Seinfeld stand-up routine where he wants the doctor to wait on him.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck with that.
And he wants the doctor to take his pants off, too.
Nice. But, you know, but if you'll notice, though, if you look at something where there really is a real competitive market, you know, people will bend over backward to make consumers happy. If you go into the Apple store, you know, you don't have to stand in line to check out. They send a guy with an iPad to you, will take your credit card, email your receipt, and you're out. The DMV doesn't work that way. And the thing about healthcare is that it's, you know, it's been partly government and partly private for so long that both sides of that equation have really forgotten how to operate.
You spend a lot of space in the book blaming the New Deal and Roosevelt for our current problems. I mean, you're going back 80 years.
Well, a lot of it does date back to that. You know, the New Deal is kind of the original sin in terms of central planning in the American economy. It really is the most significant expansion of state power. You know, we had a similar kind of thing under Wilson, what was known as war socialism at the time, but most of that was repealed after the war. And the thing about the New Deal, of course, was that it, you know, it wasn't a war measure. It was measures mostly taken in response to the Great Depression, and it was all intended to be permanent. Although, when you think about it, some of those things just simply, they were never sustainable from the beginning. I mean, you know, if you have something like Social Security that requires every generation to be larger than the generation before it to work out financially, that it's going to at some point not work because you're not going to have an infinitely growing population. Just we're a species. We don't do that. There's limited space on the planet and in the country. But no one really thought that far ahead. They figured they would just, you know, muddle through when the time came. And, of course, now we've muddled to this point, and it's simply not working. So, yeah, I mean, there was a tremendous amount of harm done to the country by the New Deal and by the institutions created therein. It's a typical example of, you know, what Robert Higgs calls the phenomenon of crisis and Leviathan. Things go wrong. The state gets larger in response to this emergency. The emergency goes away, and the emergency powers stay. You know, if you'll ever notice on your telephone bill, you pay a little tax on long-distance service if you're one of these antediluvian people that still has a landline. And that was instituted as an emergency measure to fund the Spanish-American War. It's, you know, it's still there. So there are things that we might have done in the 1930s that seemed sensible at the time, and maybe even were sensible at the time. I'm not sure. But they're not sensible for this time. You know, there are not a lot of 1935-era products that are still in use. We don't drive 1935 cars. We don't use 1935 information technology, typewriters and telegraphs and all the rest of it. But we still have a retirement system that's based on a model that was from 1935. And I just don't see how that's how that seems like a good idea to anybody.
If you'd like to join in the conversation with Kevin Williamson, the name of the book is The End Is Near, and it's going to be awesome. The number to call, 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. So I'd like to move along to healthcare. We've just come from healthcare to education, where you have a lot to say. What solutions do you see there? Homeschooling? You're talking, K-1 through 12.
Yeah. Well, again, it's one of those things where I admire homeschoolers a lot, and I think homeschooling is a great phenomenon. I refer to it as the only authentically radical movement in American society right now. But, it's not for everybody. And, again, the idea that there's one system that's good for everybody is part of the problem. So I would like to see a multiplicity of educational options. Homeschooling is one thing. Private schools are another thing. Vocational training is another possibility. People want different things out of education. People need different things out of education. And the idea that we've got, essentially one model of education for K through 12 anyway, that comes from, Prussia under Bismarck and this kind of factory model of the state, and that the schools are there to produce widgets for the workforce in the form of people trained to do certain kinds of things, is, again, just an idea that I think is really desperately out of date. And schools confuse, they don't know which is the product and which is the consumer. They treat the students as though they're the product, and the state is the consumer, and it really should be the other way around, where students are the consumer and training them is their product. But it all has to start with recognizing the fact that people have different desires and needs and want different things out of an education.
And is that what you mean when you say we need a modular approach, so that one size does not fit all?
You certainly probably want to add more choices as students get older. I mean, maybe, kindergarten's going to look pretty similar for everybody. But, people's talents and interests start to diverge widely by, fifth, sixth grade, around then. And we should always make, to the extent that we can, sort of classical liberal education available to everybody who wants it. But we should stop kidding ourselves that everybody wants it. And stop trying to force it on people who don't have an interest in it or don't have a talent for it, and to make other things available to them as well. We forget that there are all sorts of really good ways to make a living that don't require a bachelor's degree and a cubicle in an office. But we treat people socially like losers if they have jobs that didn't require them to go to college. And that's a social attitude that I'd really like to see changed. There are construction people here in New York, where I live, who are specialized people who do things like, installing glass on tall office buildings and things like that. And, these guys make $300,000 to $350,000 a year in this very specialized occupation. But, they didn't go to graduate school, so, they're not smart people. And that's just a really bad attitude, I think. So there are people who are going to want to do things besides go to law school, right, besides become computer programmers, and I think they should be encouraged and supported.
What's behind the decline over the past few decades of the large number of the great American middle class? Or do you disagree that that's happened?
Oh, no, gosh, it's definitely happened. Men's incomes in the United States, in real terms, in inflation-adjusted terms, peaked in 1973. So when I was born, that was the high watermark for men. And household incomes have only gone up since then because of the participation of more women in the full-time labor force. The short version of that story is that the economic conditions that prevailed from the end of World War II until the 1970s were really unusual, and they were always going to change. In 1950, the United States has something like 80% of the world's surviving non-military manufacturing capacity. And that's not because we were so smart, because we were so good, even though we were, you know, smart and good. It's because the rest of the world was a smoking ruin that had been destroyed by World War II. Europe, the great manufacturers of Europe, England, Germany, were tore up. They had, you know, essentially no functioning economy. Half of Europe, of course, was under communism after that. Japan was a mess. China was a mess. India was going through partition and wasn't going to emerge as a real economic player until the late 1980s, early 1990s. So, you know, 1955 looks pretty good for us because we're basically the only game in town. And so you did have that phenomenon that was really nice there for that one generation of people who were high school graduates who could go to work for a factory, keep the same job for 40 years, work 40 hours a week, have real security in that, a middle-class income, buy a house, send their kids to school, send them to college. But that was just never destined to survive. Unfortunately, a lot of our assumptions about what life should look like and can look like are rooted in that one really unusual period in our history. In the 70s, the 80s, and certainly accelerating now, you've got the phenomenon of globally integrated markets and supply chains, Americans having to compete in a very direct way with workers from all over the world and from firms all over the world, which is especially hard on those who have fewer skills or those who have skills that are easily replicated in other places. You know, if you look at where the growth in jobs and wages have been, they're in things that are location-specific, like healthcare and to a lesser extent, education, because you really can't, you know, farm those things out. So the reality is that we're going to have to compete with Chinese and Indians and Koreans and Europeans all over the world, and that's going to require a great deal of capital investment on our part to make our labor more valuable. You know, one of the things that is misunderstood is that it's not a question of low wages, but it's a question of high productivity. Germany is a big manufacturing country, and Mercedes aren't cheap, and the people who build Mercedes aren't cheap either. You know, those are not low-wage people working over in the BMW factory and the Mercedes factory and the Audi factory, but they're highly productive workers. And in Germany, you've had a phenomenon of the unions and the management, people working closely together to keep that productivity up and to keep German workers comparably preferable to outsourced sources. And we haven't done that as much. You know, we've had a much more antagonistic relationship between unions and management, between managements and government. And that has produced real costs for American workers.
We're speaking with Kevin Williamson. He covers the intersection of economics, politics, and culture for National Review and National Review Online. The book is The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. One more break now, and we'll be right back.
And Wednesday edition, Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, and we're visiting with Kevin Williamson. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. First up, we have Dave in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. Your guest was talking about healthcare. And that Medicare and Medicaid don't work. Well, one of the reasons why it doesn't work is because it seems to me that a certain brand of politician has been for the past 30 years making cuts to the funds for those services. So saying that Medicare and Medicaid doesn't work, given what has happened, is like saying that public transportation doesn't work because the buses are all broken. And the buses are all broken because the person who's saying that it doesn't work has done everything in his power to ensure the destruction of the engines of the buses. The other thing about education.
Could I interrupt there for a second, please?
Well, I'd like to finish. Because
well, let him address that first point.
Let him address that.
Yeah, if you'll go back and look at federal budgets from the time Medicare and Medicaid were instituted until now, you will never find a single cut in either of those programs.
Well,
you just won't,
all
not
I
there.
Hear about is all I hear about is people making cuts to state and federal healthcare services.
Yeah, just go, you know, go look at them. Go pull up the federal budgets. You can look at them. There's never been a federal cut to Medicare or Medicaid spending.
Yeah, and another thing is, the thing about education, homeschooling, and private schools and whatnot. We got to part ways on that as well. I have seen parents who would not be able to homeschool their own children. All right, getting rid of the public school system or privatizing it in the form of charter schools, that is what hasn't worked. Right now, there's been several studies about charter schools here in the state of Florida, and they're actually doing worse than the public schools are. And in fact, here in Miami-Dade County, the public schools have consistently, for the past several years, scored higher than the charter schools. The charter schools have no oversight. There's nobody coming in to check and see if the teachers are actually doing their jobs. You know?
Yeah, well, as I said, I don't think homeschooling's for everybody. I think you're right. There's certainly families that wouldn't be able to do that it wouldn't make sense for. Charter schools, I think, are probably an overrated phenomenon in a lot of ways because they're still, you know, quasi-public institutions. And if you're informing me that something in Miami-Dade County doesn't work very well, it's not going to be very surprising to me. I don't know of anything in Miami-Dade County that works very well.
Kevin Williams, discuss your view of Tea Party politics, and also, where do you place yourself? Do you consider yourself libertarian?
Yeah, libertarian's a fair description of my politics. It's not probably a complete one, and I don't think of myself as being a doctrinaire libertarian by any stretch of the imagination. You know, there are lots of things that I'm open to, especially if they involve, you know, social experimentation and reducing monopoly powers. But I don't have to have the whole loaf of bread all at once. I'm definitely willing to bargain and negotiate on those things. The Tea Party. The Tea Party, well, I think it's a little bit like Occupy in the sense that, they are flip sides of one another. They both recognize that there is an unhealthy relationship between big government, between finance, and big business. The Tea Party phenomenon started off with people mad about the bailouts. I think people often forget about that. Those really where it started. And those were certainly, you know, a problematic program, and people were right to be opposed to it and right to object to them. I'm generally kind of skeptical of populist movements in general. I think that that people in herds don't tend to make very good political decisions. It's difficult to make good political decisions just sort of categorically. But I think the thing that's misunderstood about the Tea Party is that it didn't emerge as an alternative for people who were dissatisfied with Democrats. It emerges as an alternative for people who are dissatisfied with Republicans, particularly people who are dissatisfied with the Republican establishment, the party leaders in Congress, certain aspects of the legacy of the Bush administration. And that's really what the Tea
Party
is about.
It wasn't a big part of it, kind of a campaign against Barack Obama?
Well, a lot of it is very personal. People intensely dislike Barack Obama.
And were there racial overtones in that dislike?
No, I don't really think so. I mean, there's racial overtones to everything in American life to an extent. I think Barack Obama would be probably treated even more roughly if he were, if you look like John Kerry. Of course, it's hard to be sympathetic to people who look like John Kerry.
Why do you think he'd be treated more roughly if he looked like John Kerry?
Well, I think that Americans rightly are reserved and sensitive to an extent when it comes to questions of race, both, out of good reasons, because we have a terrible legacy on that issue, and also out of self-interest. No one, in politics wants to be accused of being a racist. And so things like, even things like the way comedians, treat the president, I think, he gets treated with a certain amount of extra gentleness because of our anxieties about the issue of race. But I don't think that the Tea Party and the general populist right's intense personal dislike for Barack Obama has much or anything to do with race. I think it has to do with his values, with his demeanor, with his policy agenda, and partly the class issue, I think, too. You know, Obama represents this kind of managerial class of people coming out of law school, with the idea that they're smarter than people and therefore should be entrusted to run everyone else's lives for them. And I think that that certainly rubs people the wrong way.
I have to go back. You said that nothing works very well in Miami-Dade County.
it's one of the worst governed places in the country.
Well, that's interesting, because I read that you said a local government could be more of an answer, and taking it even down to the city block level if need
be.
Yeah, but aren't local governments just as political as the federal government?
Yeah, they're easier to manage. In general, I prefer to see stuff done at a local level. But yeah, there's some terrible local governments out there. I mean, there's a reason Detroit looks like Detroit, and that's because it's got a city government that's corrupt and incompetent. And there's just no way around that. The effects of that sort of corruption and incompetence and just inability to perform scale up. You know, as you go up the ladder from city to state to federal government, they become more consequential. Which is one of the reasons why we like to see things done more at the local level. But also, it's easier to get rid of a city council in Lubbock, Texas, than it is to get rid of a bad Congress in Washington. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to have problems at the local level. I mean, if you look at the way, the biggest American cities are governed, they're a wreck. You know, Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, New York, oddly enough, is better governed than most big cities in the country. Which is one of those things that always surprises me. But, and Miami is certainly an example of terrible, terrible local government.
And can you give us some examples? I mean, we're here.
Yeah. You look at the performance of your schools. You look at your budget. You look at the general economic weakness of South Florida, the inability to really get the most out of your labor force, things like that. I think there's some fair criticisms to be made there.
We're speaking with Kevin Williamson. He covers economics, politics, and culture for National Review and National Review Online. Name of the book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. One more short break now, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is Topical Currents on WLRN. We're speaking with Kevin Williamson about his book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. Kevin, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
You can go to nationalreview.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at KevinNR.
And we'll take another call or two. This is Adam in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hey, thanks. Two quick comments before I ask my questions, I guess in response to the previous caller. I think sometimes cuts are also just reductions in the spending increases. And then also with the homeschool, a lot of the parents will hire tutors if they're not competent enough to teach their students. But the question I have is, was there anything in the New Deal that affected the healthcare industry up to today, and then what would it take to get, I guess, some stable prices in the healthcare industry?
Yeah, one big thing in the New Deal that is a major problem with healthcare today is the linkage between employment and health insurance. So, in the lead up to the war, you have the Roosevelt administration imposing wage and price controls. So employers were not able to offer people higher salaries to attract better workers, and thus was born the fringe benefit, as we call it, which healthcare is the most important one. And combined with the fact that we don't tax those benefits as income, that created a system by which health insurance was strongly linked to employment. And the existence of non-employer-based alternatives was severely limited by that tax treatment and by other economic factors associated with that. So I don't know if you'd call that a New Deal program exactly, but certainly something from the Roosevelt administration that's still with us and still a basic part of why we don't have a functioning market there.
What are your views on privatizing Social Security?
Yeah, I don't even know what that means.
Of having people be able to manage their money and
invest. Yeah, I mean, letting people make investments for themselves. Yeah, I think that's great. I think if you privatize Social Security, it's no longer Social Security. And if it's Social Security, it's not private. But yeah, replacing it with a system based on actual assets and investing in, you know, real goods and services, yeah, I think that would be better in all sorts of ways, not only because it would produce returns for the people who invest thusly, but also because that money would be put into actual productive enterprise. I mean, that's the flip side people always fail to appreciate about this.
But what if someone's savings is lost on Wall Street, such as the 28 big recession?
Yeah, I mean, there are going to be you know, ups and downs, obviously, and you have to do this on a long-term horizon. You need to, you know, do it sort of competently. You know, you often have this. We get a story like this once every 10 years where some interesting financial tool emerges on Wall Street that makes sense if you're J.P. Morgan, or it makes sense if you're a big insurance company, but probably doesn't make sense if you're, you know, an individual making $50,000 a year and trying to save for your retirement. So I remember back in the, you know, in the 80s, the junk bond boom was a big thing. And junk bonds turned out to be a great investment if you had the assets to ride them out for a long time. But if you're someone who makes $50,000 a year and you've got 100% of your assets in three or four different junk bonds, well, it was just a dumb investment to make. And same thing happened with derivatives in the 90s, some real estate investments after that. You know, if you're going to have people saving for their own retirements and investing for their own retirements, obviously you need to have them putting their money mostly into, you know, extremely diversified baskets of financial tools, rather than, you know, having people who are playing Gordon Gekko and trying to, you know, pick the next hot stock and all that sort of thing. So, you know, people are going to require some guidance, I think, on that and some experience in the marketplace, and not treat it as a casino. Again, it's great to treat it as a casino if you've got $1 billion. If you don't have $1 billion, then it's maybe not the best thing to do. But, you know, that's not the only way to address that as well. You know, I get into the book some models for helping people who just simply never have enough money to save very much to retire. And it's not really a question of national wealth. You know, we've got enough money to deal with these things. We've got enough wealth in this country to deal with these things. It's a problem of trying to pay everything out of current cash flow. You know, trying to support a very large class of retired people is a difficult thing to do if you're trying to do it day in, day out of pocket with the money you currently make. It's a much easier thing to do if you actually invest over a 40-year time period and put into place investments in real assets, real goods and services, rather than these, you know, theoretical entitlements backed by nothing.
When you say the end is near, going back to your title, what do you predict that'll look like exactly, and what time frame are we talking about?
And why is it awesome?
Well, it's awesome because the stuff we have right now doesn't actually work very well, and we're going to replace it with stuff that does. Whether you're talking about how we handle healthcare or education or retirements or other sorts of things, I just simply think that our dysfunctional welfare state model is not going to be here in, call it 25 years. Some of those things will go away more quickly than that. You know, you've got situations right now where you've got states like Illinois and California that in, you know, 8 or 10 years will be spending the majority of their projected tax revenue just on pensions for retired government workers. That simply is not going to be sustainable. People are not going to pay those sorts of taxes just to pay for pensions for government workers while everything else falls apart. People are going to demand that these things change. And, you know, we could double all federal taxes over the next 20 years and still not be able to pay our Social Security obligations. And we're not going to do that. You know, we're not going to double taxes and just dedicate that money to Social Security. So with that in mind, you know, it's an opportunity to reform and to replace these things. And, you know, always the hard part for me and for people who look at the world the way I do is that question you ask, well, what does your model look like? What does your alternative look like? And, you know, it's like asking someone in the 19th century what a car is going to look like in the 21st. It's just not a predictable thing. It's not something that can be designed, even by very, you know, smart people.
Hmm. And we'll move along to Victor in Miami. I'm short on time, Victor. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. The title of your book certainly sounds interesting, and it prompted me to ask this question. Oftentimes, there's a need to look at things that need to be changed down below the various aspects of what happens, say, in the federal government and the various things that are involved with the changes there. My question has to do with, what are your thoughts on maybe changes that need to, or maybe need to be looked at within the structure of the government itself, which might be something that comes out of...
Okay, Victor, we'll have him answer that. I'm really short on time.
Sure.
Kevin?
Yeah, well, I think the main challenge there is only asking government to do things that government actually is good at, which is things like running the military and law enforcement and border patrol and things like that. Things that are, you know, traditionally governmental competencies, rather than trying to do things like manage a complex healthcare economy.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. We've been visiting with columnist and author Kevin Williamson. He covers economics, politics, and culture for the National Review. And once again, the website, Kevin?
The best place to find me is nationalreview.com.
And we'll have a link to you and your book on our website, WLRN.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical director from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's our 4th of July special with the popular Capitol Steps Ensemble. Friday, it's Ed Bell on the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, Bonnie and I discuss the Tea Party. And to the calendar, from the sublime to the ridiculous. On this day in 1883, 130 years ago, the birth of novelist and short story master Franz Kafka in Prague. Metamorphosis, Trial, America. Most of his work was published posthumously. And on this day, 1947, 66 years ago, the birth of columnist and humorist Dave Barry. He was first hired by the Miami Herald's Tropic magazine in 1983 and won a Pulitzer in 1988. One more while we remember Thurston Howell and wife Lovey on Gilligan's Island. On this day, 1989, 24 years ago, the death of Jim Backus in Los Angeles, a Cleveland guy. He also played James Dean's father in Rebel Without a Cause. Also the voice of one Quincy Magoo. That's Mr. Magoo. So we leave with a thought from Dave Barry, who's written some 24 nonfiction works, the last title, I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Quote, thus, the metric system did not really catch on in the States, unless you count the increasing popularity of the 9mm bullet. Have a great holiday, everyone. For Bonnie Berman and our crew, thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, next from NPR News.